Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, and your chair for this evening. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers this evening, Dana Goldfind and Dan Jeller, who will be speaking about their latest amazing film, Galapagos Affair, Satan Came to Eden. For over 20 years, Emmy Award-winning directors, producers, and writers, Dan Jeller and Dana Goldfind, have jointly created critically acclaimed multi-character documentary narratives that braid their characters' individual personal stories to form a larger portrait of the human experience. Their award-winning Something Ventured, made in 2011, played at festivals internationally and was broadcast nationwide on Public Broadcasting System, PBS. Jeller and Goldfind's work also includes the following films. Ballet Russe, that's my French, was recognized as one of the top five documentaries of 2005 by both the National Society of Film Critics and the National Board of Review, and appeared on a dozen critical 10 best films lists, including those of Time Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Hollywood Reporter, and Slate. There's another film, Now and Then, From Frosh to Seniors, premiered theatrically in October 1999 and aired on PBS in October 2000 as the lead program of the Independent Lens series. Kids of Survival, The Art and Life of Tim Rollins and KOS in 1996 was a feature-length documentary about the South Bronx-based art group Tim Rollins and KOS, which aired on Cinemax in September 1998 and was the recipient of two National Emmy Awards. Yeah, really. Frosh, 9 months in a freshman dorm, was filmed in 1994, and the award-winning Isadora Duncan, Movement from the Soul, was filmed in 1988. And now it is my very great pleasure to welcome our distinguished speakers, Dana Goldfind and Dan Jeller.
Thank you very much. A very kind introduction. Can you hear me? I might have mucked with this thing over here. Okay, good.
Okay, great. Can you hear me too? Oh, great. It's the summer of 2007. No, sorry. It's the summer of 1998.
Eight.
Sorry. 2007 is when we started filming. The summer of 1998, Dan and I were extremely lucky because we found ourselves on a two-week sailing trip through the Galapagos Islands, and we had been hired by a friend of ours who had received a grant from the National Science Foundation to do a Darwin-oriented project for middle school kids. And Dan was going to do the camera work, and I was going to do the sound work. And we went to the islands and didn't know anything about them other than the fact that they were discovered by Darwin, and we were going to spend a couple weeks going from island to island and filming the flora and the fauna and the iguanas and the finches and all of, you know, the creatures that we know about from Darwin. So, to our great surprise, on the second night of the trip, just rummaging around in this little shelf that was in the kitchen of the boat, I pulled this book off the shelf, and it was called, Galapagos Islands of Paradise or something, some such thing. And it was about, lo and behold, the human history of the islands. And, you know, there's no indigenous people that live on the islands. So it was quite a shock to see that there was enough, quote unquote, human history to fill a 200-page book. So I instantly flipped it open and started going through the pages and was drawn instantly to the last chapter, which was called Murder in Paradise. And as a true crime aficionado, I quickly just devoured those. It was only 12 pages, but in those 12 pages, it told the story of this kind of misanthropic Berlin doctor and his girlfriend slash patient who left Germany in the summer of 1929, hoping to go to an uninhabited island and create their version of Eden and live with no one else. And then, and we're there more or less in a survivor mode, at least, for a year and a half until, lo and behold, other people started hearing about them. And they were quickly dubbed the Adam and Eve of the islands, of the Galapagos. And people, Germans mostly, decided that they were going to go and copy them. And so, much to Dr. Ritter and Doris Strausch's chagrin, these people started arriving. And the first ones to arrive were the Wittmer family. And they kind of fancied themselves to be a Swiss Family Robinson type group. It was a mother, a father, a teenage son, and she was pregnant with her first child. The teenage son was from a prior marriage. Anyway, so, and then what really rocked the boat and caused the murder in paradise aspect of the story was this wacky self-described baroness arrived with multiple lovers and these plans to build a hotel. So if you can imagine, your idea of paradise is living on an island with no one else, and you get there and someone else arrives with their idea of paradise and it involves building a hotel. You know, what do you do? Anyway, so in these 12 pages, you know, there were fabulous characters, and then this, you know, these disappearances. I don't want to give it away too much because you, if you haven't seen the film, then you should. But anyway, so there was, you know, sex and romance and death and murder and intrigue. And when I finished reading the 12 pages, I showed it to Dan, and we were talking about it. And Miguel, who was our advisor, our naturalist on the boat, said, well, you know, the old lady is still alive. And at that point, we didn't know who the old lady was, but the old lady was Margaret Wittmer, who was the female part of the Swiss Family Robinson family that came second. And so that began it was the beginning of me begging to go to Floriana and meet the old lady, Margaret Wittmer. But the way the Galapagos works is you're down there on a boat, and your boat has a very, very specific itinerary, and you cannot just willy-nilly go to Floriana to meet Margaret Wittmer. So Doug, our dear friend who'd hired us, explained to me very carefully that no, Floriana was not on the itinerary. We were not going to go to Floriana. And every single morning I woke up and said, it became this running joke on my part. I think he was really angry by the, you know, 10th day when I said, okay, come on today, Doug. But lo and behold, we were on this beautiful boat on the outside, but on the inside it kept breaking down. And finally, I think it was the 11th or 12th day out of this 14-day trip, Doug stormed into our cabin and said, Dana, I know you made this happen. The boat just broke down. We have to go to Floriana. So I leapt up and down. I was so happy, and we you know, went on to the island. It was the only place we could take a shower, and Miguel, who at that point had become a friend and knew me enough to know that I loved to ask questions and that I was going to ask Margaret all kinds of questions, he said, listen, you can meet her, but she's an old lady and she's a friend of mine, and if you say one thing to her about anything that happened in 1934 on Floriana Island or the Baroness or, you know, the Ritters, I might have to kill you. And then he proceeded to sit next to me as Dan and myself and Miguel spoke with Margaret. And so I didn't really say anything until the very, very end. And she talked about her life on the island, and she was quite old, so she kind of rambled. She talked about people like Roosevelt, other famous people coming to visit her, but obviously never once mentioned the Baroness or any of the things that we really wanted to hear about. So we spent, you know, maybe, I don't know, 90 minutes, and then we were kind of getting escorted out by Miguel and Margaret's daughter. And then just as we were about to leave, she looked at us and said, "In la boca cerrada no entran moscas." We didn't speak Spanish at the time, but the way she said that And the stare.
Which means a closed mouth admits no flies.
Right, right. So I knew it was really important. Dan knew it was really important. We both looked at Miguel, and Miguel said, I'll tell you what it means when we get back on the boat. And but we knew it was really important. And it was, yes, a closed mouth admits no flies. And so we sort of looked at each other, and we said she was trying to tell us something, you know, what a fabulous experience we've just had.
Well, so, you know, when we make a documentary, usually the subjects find us or we trip across them. We rarely have a long-range plan of this movie, then that movie. And in the ones that appeal to us, they have to have a great story because it's a narrative art form, long-form documentary. But at the same time, sometimes the characters aren't great. And there's an emotional content to a movie that if you have a screen character, you need to be able to identify with them, put yourself in their shoes, and sort of live their life for a little bit. And sometimes they're great films with fabulous characters, but nothing happens. And so the story isn't there. And in this case, we knew right away we had both. I mean, these were outlandish, amazing characters. And the story was off the charts bizarre. I will never find a story that's this crazy in another movie. But the other part we look for is something that usually doesn't reveal itself until we're well into making a film, which is some meta story, some meta reason for the film, some larger theme or philosophical concept that emerges as we start to make the movie. Because without that, we've got a nice corker of a story, but really, what does it mean? And usually we proceed on an instinct about that. And with all our films, even with the Ballet Russe film about the famous dance company, we got into it. Thank you. Great characters, great story, but it was only partway through we thought, wow, this is about how someone who gets to their very senior years looks if they've done something they've loved all their lives. They radiate. And Kids of Survival, which you mentioned, Karen, in the beginning, we started shooting this process of these artists and their mentor in the South Bronx. And only partway through did we realize it's how if you grow up in a shattered, impoverished community, you internalize what we call the big no, that you will fail. You think you're going to fail, and so you seek failure, even though you might have success at your fingertips. So with each movie, we look for the meta story. And in this story, it was partway through we realized also that it's a story about paradise and whether paradise is a place or a state of mind, because these people all went to find paradise and variously didn't, at least on this one island. So we thought, this is great. We have all the elements in our reading of the material. Now, how do we make a movie out of it? Because they're all dead. There's nobody around. And
except the old lady.
Except the old lady. And by the time we started on the movie, she couldn't have been in the movie because we were busy with Ballet Russe at that point. And we hadn't done reenactments, and the thought of making this movie with reenactments, it just would have come off false, I think, because the story is so bizarre, no one would have believed it in the first place, right? So we thought, well, you know, we're kind of stuck. What do we do? And then our same friend Doug Wynott, who's a local filmmaker and curriculum developer, was starting another science education project with a professor at USC who had led trips to Galapagos and mentioned to Doug that there was an archive rotting away in Doheny Library at USC with footage taken over the course of 5 years by Captain Alan Hancock and his crew as they made a scientific expedition down the Americas out to Galapagos, and Hancock became obsessed with what was happening on Floriana. And Doug called us up right away and said, you guys, you're obsessed with this movie. Your wife made the boat break down. you need to look at this archive. And so we worked with a professor, Bill McComas, who introduced us to the archivist, Melinda Hayes, and we said, we will make an arrangement because these film cans no one really knew what was on them or if they were even salvageable, that we would pay to try to salvage them and translate them to a digital format, give them a copy in exchange for the rights to the footage. And they agreed. And that really began to at least give us a sense that there could be a visual component that would make it a movie and not a book. And that was the amazing footage that started going through the Telecine device, and we thought this is unreal. And in fact, some critics still believe that this was a hoax. Critics of our the Galapagos Affair movie, a few have written and said, one day I'm sure it'll be revealed as a hoax. I assure you it is not a hoax. It's the real deal.
Yeah, it was. So all of that, all of the footage was shot by during the trips that were arranged by Alan Hancock, who was this incredible industrialist. If you're familiar with Hancock Park in Los Angeles, that was his property. He was worth a ton of money, and one of his vocations was a scientist, and the other was a sailor. And so he, every year for 8 years, starting in 1931, would take a group of scientists, world-renowned scientists, down to down the coast of the Americas, and they'd always spend quite a bit of time on the islands collecting specimens. And because he knew how to travel in style, he traveled with a 35-millimeter cameraman and also a chamber orchestra. All the scientists on the boat had to be able to play an instrument. And so they would go down, and they did this every year. And the first year that they were there, they stumbled upon Dora and Friedrich on Floriana, and they became as captivated by them as they were by the you know, iguanas and the finches and the tortoises and all of the flora and fauna on the islands. And they filmed them in kind of that way, but they also became friends. So Alan Hancock, as a trustee of USC, had just stored all of this footage, as well as this incredible set of written documents that we had access to, which was several letters that were written between by Dora Strausch, Margaret Wittmer, Friedrich Ritter, describing what was going on the island. An early journal of Margaret's that was never published, but that told a slightly different story than her actual published book. The journal of John Garth, who was this very young scientist who went on all eight of the trips through the islands and became one of our characters in our film. So we, in addition to getting this amazing motion picture footage and also still photos that were shot by Alan Hancock and his scientists, we got access to all this written material so we could develop a first-person story that allowed us to sort of do a Rashomon-style script where each of these people could tell things from their perspective, and then, you know, we could let the audience decide what they really thought was true or not. In addition, one of the things that I in particular always do when we're starting a project is turn to eBay. I don't know how many people use eBay, but man, it is the best gift to documentary filmmaking. I found every article that had ever been written by Friedrich Ritter. He wrote a series for The Atlantic Monthly in 1931, so that's where we get his voice. I found a little 2-minute long 16-millimeter newsreel that had come out in 1935 that played in theaters and someone was selling it on eBay. So that's the other source in addition to USC. And then there's also a great website. If you guys leave here and you're interested in learning more about the human history, John Warham has a site. His name is John Warham, W-O-R-A-M. And he has developed and maintains on a daily basis a site online that has everything you'd ever want to know about the human history of the islands, starting back 500 years ago when they were first discovered. So we've got all these written materials. We've got this fabulous film footage. Dan and I realized that before we can actually start filming, which we decided we were going to do back on the islands, we should go down there without our camera and microphone and just do a research trip. So in 2007, we contacted someone who became a very important sort of supporter of the project. Her name was Ali Almario, and she runs this really wonderful sort of adventure travel company called Myths and Mountains. And she started giving us all kinds of hints about, you know, how to do the Galapagos Islands, how to get through Ecuador, how to navigate things. And finally she said, you know, I'm going down there to do my own research trip on some of the hotels and whatnot, so why don't we all go together? So in May of 2007, Dan and Allie and I went, and we met up with Miguel, our friend from 1998, who came on board and said he would help us navigate some of the politics of the island. And we just started kind of walking around the streets of Santa Cruz Island and going to Floriana and meeting the people who lived there then. And we also had to work with the National Park, who thought we were insane because we were the first filmmakers ever who had come trying to get a permit to film the people. Because that, you know, doesn't really happen. And they kept kind of scratching their heads and saying, okay, fine, whatever. And then we met the remaining members of the Vitmer family, and we tried to, you know, strike up friendships with them, which we luckily did because we wanted them to you know, collaborate and be part of the film. And while we were down there in May of 2007 meeting all these people, we all of a sudden had this epiphany that it was about more than just the Floriana story. Because as we started meeting these other people who were either very old early settlers themselves or descendants of some of the early settlers, and most of them came from Germany as well or Norway or other parts of Europe, we realized that they could become a part of the story and could help us amplify and articulate some of the things that that couldn't be told just through the first person or couldn't be understood by an audience just through the first person descriptions that we'd collected in the books and journals and letters.
Also, they didn't kill each other.
And they didn't kill each other, although sometimes they wanted to. Anyway, so Dan and I sort of scratched our heads and looked at each other and we said, oh, this is turning out to be a bigger project than we had thought. I think we're going to want to interview some of these people, and all of a sudden it really is going to become a much more complicated, we think richer, but more problematic to edit project. So there we were in the spring of 2007, trying to create some semblance of how we were going to put this thing together and how we were going to come back and film in the fall, and realizing, like, oh, wow, we've just met the DeRoy family and the Angermeyer family and all of these people that are going to now become part of this film, and it's going to be really messy but much more fun.
And we our feeling in these situations, we just shoot, get as much as we can recorded, and then we'll figure it out afterward, because it was we didn't have a notion of how it would fit, but we had a sense that their stories were relatively undocumented and the material would somehow be useful somewhere along the line, even if we couldn't find a home for it in the film in a substantial way, although we did ultimately. All right, so then it was time to go down and shoot, and we thought, well, we could shoot the ruins on Floriana. You know, there's some interest in that. We ought to see what the little spots look like where the Whitmers were and the Ritters were and the Baroness's remnants of an encampment, and shoot some of the Whitmer descendants and people on Santa Cruz Island. But you can't put a movie out on Galapagos without seeing the landscape and seeing the famous animals. So we chartered a boat to take us around. In working with the National Park, it would take us around so that wherever we were, none of the other tour boats were ever around. And it felt like we were, in a funny way, discovering Galapagos for the first time ourselves. We had it to ourselves in a funny way. So we brought a crew down, but we had no money at this point to do much. So it's not all that hard to get friends to come down to Galapagos and volunteer for free. We say, well, put you on a boat. You don't have to pay for the boat. Just fly down. So we had this wonderful volunteer crew of really dear friends, and we made a grand loop of several of the islands so that we could get the scenics and also that feel, the feel of desolation and that alien sense of Galapagos. Those of you who've been there know it, that weird sense where the animals, for the most part, don't even aren't even cognizant that you're there. They look right through you. They have not any reason to fear, and they could care less if you're snapping photos of them or in our case, shooting footage of them. You know, I will never shoot a nature movie that looks that good again, because it's easy. You know, you don't have to hide out in a blind and sweating with bugs or anything. It was really easy. And then so the other thing we did while we were down there, when we started talking to the families, We asked, do you have photos? Do you have photos of when you first came here, what it was like to grow up here, in the case of the kids who were my age? Even though most of them were not preservationists and the climate could be pretty nasty for hanging on to photos, most of them had a lot of photos. And what we do tell filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers, we say, wherever you go, bring a scanner with you. And just slap as many photos on and scan whatever you can. And we were scanning hundreds, if not thousands, of personal photos, which they were generously gave to us to use in the movie and are instrumental in the movie. And, of course, we give them back a digital copy that, you know, preserve it for posterity. And going around these different families, everyone kept saying, you have to meet this one woman, Friedel Horniman. Her mom was the godmother of Galapagos. Everyone was welcomed by her mother. And Friedel was chip off the old block and just this lovely woman. And the only thing is that she left at age 18 or 20 or so and now lives in the most northern reaches of Norway, which I call frozen Galapagos, where she was. And we thought, follow the instinct, follow the lead. And so we decided, I've never been to Norway. Let's give it a shot. And she was fantastic and warm and told all these other incredible, beautiful stories and has the penultimate line in the movie where she says, I think what people learn in Galapagos is that paradise is not a place, it's a condition, which I thought was ultimately profound. That plus Fritz Heber's comment, wherever you go, you bring yourself, both truisms.
Right, so we were getting ready to go to Norway to film Friedel, who was amazingly, even though it's at the reaches of the Netherlands, on email. And
Norway.
Well, where she lives in Kirkenes.
It's not Netherlands.
I said the reaches of Neverland. Sorry.
Got it.
Sorry.
That Neverland.
At any rate, yes. Friedel responded with an open heart, and we said, okay, we're going to go. While we were getting ready to go to Norway, we got this call out of the blue, and this is where luck comes into these projects. We always jump in with all of our feet and never know how we're going to fund these things and how we're going to finish it and what it's really going to be about. But we cross our fingers and our toes and hope that we're lucky. And in this case, one of the incredibly lucky things was while he was looking around the web, the grandnephew of Dr. Friedrich Ritter found some reference to our project and got in touch with us. And when he first wrote, it was through email, and we didn't really believe. First of all, we had no knowledge of any surviving members of either Dr. Ritter's family or Doris Rausch's family, and we didn't believe that there were any. And so to get this random email from this older doctor who lived right outside of Frankfurt and claimed to be the grandnephew of Dr. Ritter, we were like, oh, yeah, really? And he said, no, I'll send you photos to prove it. And he started sending us through the web, through the internet, these early childhood photos of Friedrich Ritter. And we said, wow, he's the real deal. And then we talked to him on the phone, and we could tell that he was this unbelievable character. So we said, you know what, let's divert our trip a little bit and stop off in Frankfurt on our way to film Friedel in Norway. And we had no idea what he was going to be like. All we knew is that he was a physician in Germany. And we'd had one kind of fussy phone call with him where he seemed a little bit uptight. And so we kind of started questioning whether or not we should have agreed to do this and whether we were going to even get anything worthwhile in an interview. And then we just said, oh, we've already bought our tickets. We'll just do this. So we get to the airport in Frankfurt, and he said he was going to pick us up there and show us how to get to his house. And we're sort of looking around. I was trying to find someone who looked like a conservative, doctor. I fancied him wearing, a suit and tie. And all of a sudden Dan said, Dana, there he is. And there was this guy with a shock of gray hair, like silver hair, just beautiful, like going back like that. And then this shirt that was unbuttoned down to here. And I said, that is not, Fritz Heber. And Dan said, Danny, he's got a sign with our names on it. And that began this incredible friendship. He's really a dear friend. We hung out with Fritz and his wife, Uta, for, I think, 2.5 days. And he really became a very important part of the film. And so it was one of those incredible little pieces of luck, and thank God for the internet, because that would have never happened, you know, 20 years ago when we were making these kinds of documentaries.
He did say, because he had some misconceptions about San Francisco people, he thought all we did was play golf, go figure, and that we would not eat meat or drink alcohol. And when he found out, well, I don't play golf, but that didn't matter so much, but that we would eat meat and drink alcohol, really for the next 72 or more hours, I feel like all we did was eat meat and drink alcohol.
And listen to his fabulous stories about his crazy grand uncle.
So then we ultimately we said, all right, it's time to start editing this movie. And we're hands-on as editors, but we really wanted to bring somebody in to work fresh with the material. We'd experienced so much, it's helpful to have somebody with an outside eye and a real talent as an editor. And Bill Weber, who's a local filmmaker editor, who whose film To Be Takei about George Takei is just out. He edited that, and he co-directed and edited We Were Here and the Coquettes movie. Wonderful editor, and he got involved and came on board at the beginning of our editing. And editing this mess, I think at first what we did, we said, well, why don't you just look at everything? And we'll give you some room. Just look at everything. And about 5 days into that, he said, you guys, I'm drowning. And what did you just do to me? He said, all right, well, let's try to map out this story. And we would use index cards on a bulletin board and come up with some notion of a structure, and quickly realized that that was too unwieldy. We backed out and said, let's just build the murder mystery up. Then we'll just start to finish the murder mystery, and then find points where we fatigue of the murder mystery and see what's happening then. And then we can make this little diversion off to the moderns, as we call them, the characters on, for the most part, Santa Cruz Island, who have these other settler stories. And that's how we began to weave in and out the movie. And it took several work-in-progress screenings. It took about 2 years to edit the movie, but several work-in-progress screenings with a group of about a dozen colleagues from different backgrounds to get it to the point where the movie was up on its feet. The early screenings are usually a lesson in deep humiliation because they're just terrible versions of the movie, and they don't work. They're bloated. They're confusing. But ultimately, because we keep subjecting ourselves to this process, things start to work out. The other part that makes it difficult is that in this movie, because we had these first-person voices to represent, well, someone had to read them, and our first go at it was to try to read them with as best as we could muster German accents. No. We said, all right, in the work-in-progress screening, people will understand if we read them in flat American accents that they're German characters, because it was so distractingly hilarious, the whole thing turned into a grand comedy. So that was the agony of listening to ourselves, cut after cut after cut.
So finally, after, I would say, almost the better part of a year, we felt like we had a cut. And or no, more like 18 months. We felt like we had a cut that was worthy of trying to find actors, real professional actors, who could take our embarrassing performances and turn them into something that would actually, you know, engross an audience. And again, remember I mentioned luck. Okay, so at that moment, huge luck. Woody Allen decides to shoot Blue Jasmine in San Francisco, and even luckier, he casts Cate Blanchett. And then really lucky, a really close friend of ours is the executive director of the Sydney Theatre Company, which is artistically run by Cate and her husband, Andrew Upton. So kind of in jest and kind of hoping something might come of it, we wrote this little note to our friend Patrick in Sydney and said, we hear that Cate's coming out here for a month, and we have this film, you saw a work in progress of it when you were here last May, and don't you think that Cate could take half an hour off from filming with Woody and come up to our house and just record the part of the Baroness, and which is really the smallest part in the film? And Patrick wrote back pretty quickly, and he said, you guys, I am not going to ask her, but what I do want to do, she doesn't know anyone in San Francisco, and I've been talking about you guys. I'm going to put you in touch by email, and if she feels like getting together with you, then, you know, get together and you ask her. And so we spent that month hanging out with her and getting to be friends, and she actually came up to our house and listened to my rendition of her, which she ultimately read, which was of Doris Roush. And if there's anything that's more humiliating than having Cate Blanchett listen to you read as an actress, me read as an actress, I don't think I've experienced it yet. But anyway, at the end of the day, we fumbled around and we ended up putting her back on the plane to Australia without having asked her, because we were so, we didn't know how to do it. We're really bad at closing the deal. And
but
so,
also, to be fair, we had gotten to be friends with her and with her husband and her boys, who were out for a little bit too. And we thought, we had to make this decision. Is she going to be a friend, or is she going to... And we decided to hold the friendship and say, let's let it pass, because she became a lovely friend, and it would have felt like we were intruding on the early stages of a friendship.
Yep. So, but flash forward a month or two, and our executive producer, Jonathan Dana, who lives in L.A., was at a screening, and sitting next to him was this woman named Margie Simpkin, who is a very respected casting director. And she said, what are you working on? And he said, you know, this thing about the Galapagos and this murder mystery. And she was like, oh, is that the mystery that happened on Floriana? I was down there about, I don't know, 20 years ago, and my boat got stuck in front of Floriana Island. I met Margaret Vitmer, and I want to cast this project for you. So Margie came on, and she heard that Dan and I knew Cate. And she said, I won't do this project if you're that stupid. You have to write to her tonight. She's the number one actress in the entire world. I refuse to work with you if you don't follow up on it. So we did. Long story short, once Cate came on board, she made it possible, just because of who she is, for Margie to then go and get this unbelievable cast of, you know, Diane Kruger, Connie Nielsen, Sebastian Koch, Josh Radner, did I name everyone?
Thomas Kretschmann.
And Thomas Kretschmann.
But the other thing that Cate said when we actually did talk on the phone, she said she would do any role we wanted in the movie. And later on, we'd gone to Australia to record her. She said her thought was, she would, from the very beginning watching it, she thought she wanted to participate in some way in the movie, but thought she, who the hell was she to ask for a role in the movie? So it's one of these, you know, right, leave it to Margie Simpkin to kick us in the butt. And then the rest of the story just moves on to, at that point, once we brought the voices in, which were so fantastic, to work with a wonderful composer from L.A., Laura Karpman, who worked on Something Ventured with us too, to create the musical feel to the movie, which originally we just took CDs from Trent Reznor and made this weird electronic track, temporary music, and Laura listened to it and said, okay, but this movie has sort of an older, bigger Hollywood feel to it, because the story is period piece and it's so over the top. Let me try to expand into a symphonic space with this while retaining the weirdness. And we at first, being the brilliant directors we are, said no. And then she said, well, please let me just temp some things, let me show you. And she did, and of course she was absolutely right, and created what to my mind is an amazing, unpredictable score with Indian glass bells and the Latin American cuatro guitar and a chromatic didgeridoo, as well as incredible Austrian violins, and incredible. She really did a fabulous job. And then a sound design, a sound mix, all these pieces come together to create the polish and feel of the final film. And our dream had always been for this film to premiere at the Telluride Film Festival, and we got lucky, and we did. And so that was
The Telluride Festival happens over Labor Day in Telluride, Colorado, and it's really a very, very special festival where you feel like it's about cinema and watching movies and talking about movies, and it's not so much like Sundance, which is more about you know, or a lot more about marketing and selling your film and the hype and the Hollywood vibe. So we were fortunate enough to get to experience the first screenings of this film in Telluride.
We'd already sold the film. That's what made it a little easier. So we've had two films at Sundance, and it was hugely helpful to be at Sundance.
So thank you. We're going to throw it open to questions now.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Dana Goldfein and Dan Scheller for an incredible story about an amazing film. I still don't know how you did it, even after you explained it. I still am wondering. I am Karen Kiefer, a member of the club's International Relations Member-Led Forum, and I'll be handing around the microphone to those of you who have questions. But in the meantime, we'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You are listening to The Galapagos Affair, Satan Came to Eden, with Dana Goldfein and Dan Scheller. And a reminder that this is on Netflix and on Amazon for those of you who haven't seen this amazing film that should have been nominated for the Academy Award. This is a radio message to those in Hollywood who did not do their job. Okay. Now we will have questions.
I actually have two questions. One is how much of a process was it to get the film back in? There was a picture up here that showed, I guess, you holding a copy of the film thing, and just wondering how hard that was. Number one, and number two, what was your opinion of how Friedrich died? In the movie, you posed two different takes on it, and I was just wondering what your take of it was.
Well, the first part, the film can, the original film is nitrate film footage, and 35 millimeter nitrate is combustible. And if you ever saw Inglourious Basterds, where the whole movie house goes up, and so that's all gone. But what Captain Hancock had printed it to 16 millimeter safety film, it's acetate. Saved it that way, but acetate eventually disintegrates into acetic acid, vinegar. It's called vinegar syndrome. You know, lift off the tops of the cans and get hit by a blast of vinegar. So that little piece was what some of it looked like, but most of it just had shrunken a little bit, curled a little bit, maybe had broken sprockets and could be coaxed open, cleaned, and things like that. But that, I think, because it was an exceptionally dismaying little hunk of footage. I took a picture of it while Dana was holding it.
But sadly, is this working? Yeah. Sadly, so Monaco Labs, which for years and years and years was in San Francisco, has gone out of business. But for us, luckily, it was still working, and there was an incredible film restorer there named John Carlson, and he and I sat there for days. Well, first Dan and I convinced Melinda Hayes at USC to trust us with all of this film footage. And we took every canister, even the ones that looked like they were too damaged to transfer, and we gave them to John, and he cleaned up as much as he could, and then slowly sent the footage through this Telecine at, you know, 11 or 12 frames a second, like normally it would be going at 24 frames a second, and just carefully coaxing it and trying to salvage as much as we could. We probably ultimately got about 2 hours of the footage. A lot of it was repeat because, as Dan said, this was originally 35 millimeter footage, which had been transferred to 16. But it was a long process. But every time, it was like looking for Easter eggs, basically. And you know, we'd sometimes sit there for a day and not get anything, and then sometimes there would be a day where, you know, every time he put a reel in, there was this miraculous revelation.
What was it? There was a second.
Oh, the second question was about Friedrich's. Yeah. At first, I was going to say there's a spoiler in this one because spoiler alert. It's referring to the death of Dr. Ritter. But then I remembered that actually in the very opening of the film, Dora Strauss does refer to the fact that her dear lover has died, and we do offer up two reasons for why he might have died. One of them would involve murder, and one of them would involve just sadly being poisoned by food that he ate. And, you know, I have to say, I feel differently depending on the day. And I actually, you know, Dan and I went back.
Well, but also, if he had been murdered, it would have been by Dora Strauch, his partner. Right. So
right.
That's, you really have to piss someone off to do that, I think.
But
agony by poisoning, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, Dan and I, when we first started this project, I certainly wanted to solve everything. I wanted to come up with a definitive reason for Ritter's death and, you know, find the Baroness's body. And then as we continued to research it and actually write the script and go back to the islands a number of times and read as many other true crime books and mysteries as we could get our hands on, it suddenly occurred to us that actually often when there is a solution, it's so banal. And that it ruins the whole, you know, aura and essence of what you've been reading. And so then, ultimately, I think we just looked at each other, I can't remember at what point in the process, but we said, you know what? It's okay if we don't solve it, because it's okay that there's still this fabulous mystery and that people can continue to go to the island of Floriana and feel this unsolved, unresolved story and ponder it.
There is another person I didn't mention, and we were going through, contributed in substantial ways to the movie, and that's Celeste Schaefer Snyder, who produced it with us and is sort of our right-hand person and was in there writing the script with us, shaking her head as Dana and I would go into our marital spats while editing and writing, but deserves a huge hand and also in supporting the notion about keep it open. Don't even attempt to try to solve it. It's much more interesting. And that's how we got the participation of the Whitmer family. We did it out of a real sense that it could never be solved, but to get the trust of the Whitmers and rights to Margaret's book and the family to participate on screen, we said, look, we're going to make it so that everybody is potentially culpable. It's not taking grandma and grandpa off the hook, but we're not going to pin it on them either, and that was enough for them to go along with it.
Has this film been shown in Germany and Ecuador and the Galapagos? And if so, how was it received?
That's a great question. Yes, I mean, one of our, not just dreams, but goals and you know, determinations was to actually take it back to all the places where these people lived. And so we took it back to the islands before, right after Telluride, before it showed anywhere else. We made a trip specifically to the islands and sat there, and there's no theater. So what we did is we went house to house with our laptop.
To show it privately to the people in the movie.
Yeah, there was one day when I think we watched it five times because we wanted to show it to each. These are islands, and people living on an island, as someone says in our film, it's a microcosm of the greater world, and people have spats and feuds, and so we felt like each of the individuals or the families in the story or in the film needed to watch it by themselves, and so we went back, you know, house to house and did it, and then we were lucky enough to get into the Berlin Film Festival, where it played last February, and Fritz Heber, Dr. Ritter's grandnephew, came down from Frankfurt, and he was there.
Diane Kruger was there too. That's where the red carpet and paparazzi thing happened. you know, we're documentary filmmakers. We don't get this, but we were told that well, we'll be if Diane's there and Sebastian Koch, there will be a red carpet, and you'll walk the red carpet. Okay, you know, look this way, look that. Never anything like this. And ultimately, the big outcome of that was all the fashion magazines took pictures of Diane Kruger wearing her Chanel dress. There's no mention of the movie.
Yes, there is. It says the Berlin
at
premiere.
At the premiere of a whatever. Yeah.
Anyway, but that wasn't the whole. I mean, and then we did take it back officially to Ecuador in the end of May and showed it at an Ecuadorian documentary film festival. It was in Quito, it was in Guayaquil, and then it was actually on the islands themselves in a big screening that was set up specifically for the town of Santa Cruz. And then it went from island to island, and it played in Floriana. There's four inhabited.
Yeah, they'd set it up in a room like this, and either a monitor or a little projector, and bring in a couple of speakers. But But I mean, I had wondered that would it be of interest to the colonos, to the Ecuadorians who now are the major population in the island servicing the tourist trade, would they care about these Europeans who settled? And you know, I didn't know. It might have just been culturally irrelevant. And in fact, they were completely captivated by it. You know, sellout screenings, if you want, some, they were free, so sellout screenings. But they loved it. They were fascinated by it. And it was a part of their history they had not heard before, or certainly in any kind of detailed way. So it was gratifying to bring it down there.
And then the final one was we really weren't going to rest in peace until Friedel saw it. And so we were fortunate enough to get into the Bergen Norway Film Festival, where it played last September. And the festival was so fabulous. They flew Friedel down from the top of the world in Kirkenes, and she got to sit with an audience and get flowers and be feted in Bergen. So yeah, every single person who's in the film has seen it. And miraculously, when we were going back in the fall, the first time, as we landed on the islands, we turned to each other and said, "This might be our last trip," because truly, if they hadn't liked it, I don't think we would have. I think we would have both been persona non grata. And so, after the first screening, which was actually for the Wittmer family. And they liked it. And then the second screening was for the Angermeyers, and they liked it. And we sort of breathed this huge sigh of relief, and we said, we have our friends in the islands, and we can come back.
Two questions. Am I going to be able to see this film in San Francisco anytime?
The answer to that is yes. It had been playing in the cinemas around here in last spring for a month or two. And now it won't be in theaters anymore, but it will. You can see it streaming or on DVD with Netflix and Amazon and these other venues. But it did play wonderfully in all around a bunch of theaters around the country. But here especially, I think Mick LaSalle early on gave it a very strong review, and that and a big Pink Pages section, and that helped hugely to spread the word, because films like this, there's no ad budget. We have a wonderful distributor, Zeitgeist Films, based in New York. They do a beautiful job, but they're not going to be taking out full-page ads in the New York Times to push a film like this.
But again, Netflix, it's streaming 24 hours a day, and you can also get it on DVD, and Amazon and iTunes and any of the streaming platforms.
I can't believe I didn't see it. I go to a lot of movies. Anyway, my other question is, why do you have that monitor? I'm keep waiting for you to play some parts of the movie through your whole talk.
In the very beginning, the trailer, that Karen ran the trailer at the very beginning. So, but if you stick around afterwards, she might run it again for you.
Well, I have a question. Why did Friedel go from paradise up to the Arctic Circle? And how does she like it, and how did she get along? Did she know people up there, or what's her story from that end?
So Friedel Horneman was born on the islands in 1940. And so even though she's literally from Ecuador, her parents, and her father in particular, was Norwegian, and she grew up with a Norwegian accent. I mean, the thing that's so fascinating about the settlers on the islands is that even though they were born on the islands, the settlers who were born on the islands to European parents or American parents, they had the culture of whatever their parents were. Mm-hmm. So Friedel felt very Norwegian, even though she was born on Santa Cruz Island and was the first European girl on that island. So at a certain point, when she was ready to leave her first marriage, her father was getting too old to survive on the islands. At that point, there were still only maybe 100 people that lived there, and he just couldn't get proper medical attention, so she offered to take him back to Norway. And when she got to Norway, that was where she stayed.
Well, there's a little more to the story. She had wanted to get off the islands. She, at age 16 or whatever it was, 17, was swept off her feet by a yachtsman who had come down, Forrest Nelson, who lied about his age. He was 40, said he was 30. He said he was divorced. He wasn't. And they had the wonderful time, and they sailed for a bit, but then he brought her back to Galapagos because the Darwin Station was starting up, and he felt he could build a hotel. And that's what they did of all the things.
That's
and
a spoiler.
Well, it's all right. But ultimately, she left. She needed to get away from Forrest. And when she got to Norway, felt this tremendous simpatico. And she, because she was multilingual, most of the Europeans there at that time, Spanish, French, German, English, Belgian, they could speak at all. They had to in order to play with each other. So she was working as a tour guide partly and giving presentations about Galapagos and met her husband, who's a Sami, a Laplander, Per, who, and that's why they moved all the way up, way above the Arctic Circle, to start a family there and dig out boulders from the tundra to create a dairy farm. And so they actually ran a dairy farm, raised a family, and still live up there. Her son-in-law, Ulf, when we were complaining about the mosquitoes, which are about as big as a fist, he said, well, you get used to them because at a certain point you realize that it feels like a massage when they land on you.
I really enjoyed your work with on the Ballet Russe and now the Galapagos. Can you talk about the next project? Do you know, or, you know, I'd love to hear what you might be thinking about.
Sure. You know, we have a couple that we're just starting to push forward. It really does take a full, for us anyway, it takes a full year after finishing a film to sort of get it safely out into the world, have it fledge. And so I think in the end of September when Friedel saw the film in Norway, we kind of looked at each other and said, okay, it's time now to start another one. It felt like a complete circle. The only thing that we can say right now, because they're in such early stages of development, one's a music film, a music documentary, and one has to do with animals and an animal sanctuary. Never done anything with either of those topics before, which is part of what the draw is, in the same way that we had never done anything with ballet before Ballet Russe.
Sure.
What is the current breakdown of the population in the Galapagos, and what did they like ethnically and education and so forth?
It's a very good question. So to work backward from the tourist trade, there are about 180,000 people a year going through Galapagos as tourists. And so that requires an awful lot of people to staff the boats and the hotels and restaurants and prepare food. So there are unofficial and official counts of how many people are on the islands, predominantly on Santa Cruz Island and somewhat on San Cristobal, and then much less in a couple other spots. Probably about 30,000 people, almost entirely Ecuadorian, mainland Ecuadorian, because you can make a pretty good living working in the various trades in the islands, and mainland Ecuador is not a place to be poor. The social welfare net is pretty shattered, and the economy had tanked horribly in the year 99, 2000 when they dollarized the economy. So there's not a lot of work in mainland Ecuador. So for folks to be able, especially Andean indigenous folks, to come out to the islands and work on the boats and so forth, is a real lease on life. Now, the problem is that they don't want too many people on the islands because it can begin to, even more than it has, destroy the ecosystem.
Oh, you know what I was going to say, too, is most of the islands, there's 16, only four of them have human inhabitants, and the way that those four got the human inhabitants is when the islands were declared a national park at the end of the 60s, they just grandfathered in the places that people had already settled on. And so those were four islands and just little pieces of land. And nothing beyond those four islands will ever be developed or allow for human inhabitants, thank goodness. So that's how the land was sort of divvied up. And in the beginning, it was mostly Norwegians and Germans and Europeans, a handful of Americans. Even though the islands have always been owned by Ecuador, they're 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador. But once Ecuadorians started realizing that there was, and the Ecuadorians considered them basically suitable only for prison colonies. That's what they were kind of used on and off for. There were a handful of failed attempts to set up prisons and work camps. But once, actually, Friedel Horniman and Jack Nelson, her then husband set
Forrest.
And Forrest Nelson, her then husband set up the first Hotel Galapagos on Santa Cruz, and the tourism, the idea of tourism started to take root. And this is in the 60s. Slowly, Ecuador realized, oh, these islands could actually become tourist places, and we could actually make money from that. And so once tourism became a real viable concern, then the islands sort of became inhabited by much, much more of the Ecuadorian population. Now, the language down there really is Spanish, as opposed to when the first settlers came, it was kind of a mishmash.
Well, we have a little failed attempt at a prison island off here, our coast at Alcatraz.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, it has come time to end the program, but our thanks goes to Dan Jeller and
Thank
Dana Goldfein for a fantastic program.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you for having us.
We also want to thank our audiences here as well as our radio audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.